This is Building Bridges, produced and hosted by Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash.
Georgia prisoners in longest strike in history against the U.S. penal system say enough is enough is enough.
We look at work, but in a very interesting context. Thousands of men from Augusta, Baldwin, Hancock, Hayes, Macon, Smith, and Telfair State prisons went on strike to press the Georgia Department of Corrections to stop treating them like slaves and institute programs that address their basic human rights. Some of their demands are:
1. A living wage for work. 2. Educational opportunities. 3. Decent health care. 4. An end to cruel and unusual punishments. 5. Decent living conditions. 6. Nutritional meals. 7. Vocational and self-improvement opportunities. 8. Access to families. And 9. Just parole decisions. On December 9, 2010, the Georgia prisoners refused to work, stopping all activities in a peaceful protest for their human rights.
This is a heroic act of resistance to inhuman prison conditions and racism. We're joined by Edward O. DuBois, the president of the Georgia State Conference, the NAACP, and we thank you so much for joining us. I know things have been extremely hectic.
Thank you all for having me, Ken and Mimi.
Let's begin by catching us up. What actually is happening with the brothers that are on a work strike in the Georgia State prison system?
You know, now we want to give a good report to our people. We were able to negotiate a fact-finding team to go in and talk to these men. And for the first time today, our request was granted. And so we had 7 people who have spent an entire day in the prison system. We don't know the results of the information that they've gathered, but we are sure that it's going to reflect what the prisoners said was happening in this prison system.
Who's the fact-finding team composed of?
The fact-finding team is composed of what we now call the Coalition of Respect for Human Rights, organizations like the NAACP, ACLU, the Nation of Islam. We've got the Criminal Justice Department out of Texas. So we're made up of a diverse group of people, a group of organizations that have put the best skill set in the prison. And we were able to talk to whether the inmates were in the hole, whether the inmates were in the kitchen, or whether the inmates was in the field. We were able to talk to those inmates. And again, we're hopeful that now that we have been able to get in, this is just the first step, that we can now begin to confront Georgia on this inhumane treatment of prisoners.
And what, to your understanding, has been the treatment of prisoners? What has this inhumane treatment meant for the prisoners?
So for an example, some of the feedback that we have been getting from the prisoners was that the heat would be turned either down or off. And many of you know that in Georgia, the temperatures have been 18, 17, really below freezing temperatures. And when you treat prisoners in that kind of way, and then deny them access to health in many cases. And when you get prisoners who say that not only are they being treated without respect, but then they are unconfirmed right now, but we're certainly working to confirm them. Stories where inmates talked about even being beat, that certainly raised a concern about how people are being treated in this prison system.
Is this retribution now for the strike, or is this symptomatic of many other conditions that they faced that were really cruel and inhumane?
You know, I think that's a good question. I think some of it is symptomatic. Most of it is, as a matter of fact. It took prisoners who were able to cross racial lines and cultural lines, and if you can believe it, gang lines, where you can get someone from the Aryan Nation working with a brother from the Nation of Islam on the inside, and when you can get prisoners working through 6 or 7 prisons, it says to me that when these people can come together on one accord, we have a problem in the prison systems in Georgia.
And one of the demands has been basically pay for work, that they get paid for the work they do. What kind of work do they do, and what kind of conditions do they have at work?
Well, the prisoners in Georgia do all of the work that you would see done by people who at one time had employment in those areas. I mean, the prisoners are the ones you see, for example, driving through the neighborhood, getting the garbage. The prisoners are the ones that you see cleaning up all of the government buildings. The prisoners are the ones you see out on the street picking up the paper. And even now, in some of the government buildings, they're the ones who stand in the way at the bus boys and bus girls who would take the trays and put them away. It's modern-day slavery is what it is. It's free labor that when they ended slavery, in my judgment, they found a different way to get the same result out of prisons that house most of the African Americans.
One of the things that I find just amazing, you're talking about people working across some of the most hostile and aggressive and antithetical race lines ideologically. So you can imagine how horrific things are, but the magnitude of this strike, there are, you know, half a dozen prisons that were all interconnected. How in the world were the prisoners able to develop such an extraordinary cohesive network to get all these different institutions to do a work stoppage at the same time? That's quite stunning.
It's amazing. We're even in the civil rights community, all of the organizations that are working with us, we also are in awe and amazed at the level of coordination that it must have taken to get this kind of operation going. You know, we on one end applaud the inmates because without their ability to be able to coordinate these efforts, many of us would not have known exactly to what degree of treatment was going on inside of these prison walls.
I'm interested. You met with, I believe, two Department of Correction officials to gain access to the prison and to conduct this study and fact-finding mission that you're on right now with your allies. What were their views? What did they admit that anything was being done wrong to the prisoners? Or what was their take on the situation?
Well, and keep in mind, too, we have not had a chance to process the information from our fact-finding team that went into the prisons today. We won't have an opportunity to process that until tomorrow. Many of them are just being taken back to their locations, and so we haven't had a chance to gather collectively that information.
President, one of the things that just comes to mind from my background and experience in living in New York was the horror, the pain, the ugliness of Attica and what happened to people who sought to resist inhumane conditions. I'm just living in a state of apprehension that the state of Georgia could initiate some real terrifying aggression and take the lives of people who are fighting for their lives, in a manner of speaking. So am I too apprehensive? Is there a way of avoiding the wrath of the state in response to these men who are striking collectively and with absolute, really effectively passive resistance and nonviolence?
I think that's what's unique about this, and that the listening audience should be aware of that these men were peaceful. These men were nonviolent. To date, there have not been any incident of physical confrontation from any of the inmates. We know, again, that inmates have talked about physical confrontation with them. And so I hope also that the listening audience to help these men can call into Georgia's prison system, call into Georgia's governor's office and say to the governor and say to the Department of Correction and say to the leadership in Georgia that these men, the voices, the concerns need to be heard. Say to them that there needs to be no retaliation against these men for trying to find a way to let the outside world know what horrors they were going through on the inside.
I've seen reports that say that one out of every 13 adults in Georgia has been in prison. What accounts for the high imprisonment rate in Georgia?
You know, I think part of it is when you look at what the prison system is made up of, which is predominantly African Americans and the poor, you can then come to the conclusion that most of it deals with people who don't have access to capital, who cannot mount a defense. You've got the type legislation that is designed to lock people up rather than rehabilitate. So I think Georgia has to do a better job. Most people see Georgia's prison as prisons that house humans like cattle. And so we've got to fix the legislation. We've got to fix the criminal justice system. We've got to find a way that the indigent can get kind of representation they need so that they're not just put in prison.
It seems to me, as I think about these thousands of men, again, across ideological lines, across manifestations of hatred, oftentimes for each other, and sometimes each other's differences, disdain. And here they have come together. What a heroic, what a meaningful effort, and what a demonstration, it seems to me, of something affirmative, how people can learn and listen, and how useful it is when people collectively come together to fight for something better. I see this as a remarkable effort.
And an example that we all should pay attention to is that kind of unity, that kind of oneness that can result in really powerful outcomes.
And are you optimistic that there will be some level of reform from this strike?
I'm totally optimistic. Our organization and the organizations that we've partnered with have determined that we won't stop until we take these men's concerns through the Georgia system as well as through the federal government. We think that some of this may warrant the Justice Department getting involved, but we will not stop fighting this cause until change is taking place.
And are the men in lockdown now, or are they out of their cells? Is the complete stoppage of work still in effect?
The complete stoppage of work has, men have gone back to work, partly because they believe that we now, the organizations, are carrying their calls forward. And there are others that we're trying to make sure we get to. What we call the organizers, they call the conspirators. We want to make sure that those men who we consider the organizers have not been isolated somewhere, and that they themselves are suffering some kind of further consequences for bringing light to this issue.
So we don't know if the primary organizers have suffered any physical detriment at this time, or are in the hole, or what's happening to them?
We don't. We're still making our way to the organizers. One of our demands was that once we began to look in the prison, that we wanted to have an opportunity to interview the organizers, the ones that they indicated to us that they had taken out of these prisons and put in a different location.
What would you say are, aside from the demands of the prisoners themselves, like the critical demands that people in the communities, people such as our listeners who have gotten very little information from the media on this, what should we do? We should call the governor's office, we should call the Department of Corrections, and what should we say? What are those primary demands?
First demand demand that no retaliation take place against people who organize a very nonviolent and peaceful demonstration. And secondly, that the governor, as well as the Department of Correction and legislators, really take a look at the concerns of the inmates. They are very fair, they're very legitimate, and then it speaks to human rights issues. Some people may look at these prisoners and say, you know, what are you asking? You're a prisoner. What do you expect? But our message is even prisoners deserve to be treated decently. So we hope that they can carry the message of listening to and really paying attention to and acting on these inmates' concerns.
Is there a website or a number that people can tune into, in a manner of speaking, so they can keep abreast of the situation and do exactly what you told us to show their support?
Well, I want them the number 404-577-5555. 404-577-8977. I give that number again, 404-577-8977. Or they can go to our website, and we'll be posting the information of our website. Is naacpga.org.
I can't thank you enough. I know it's been very, very hectic. We are definitely in support. Our listeners will certainly register their concerns, and I hope we can keep in touch with you to get reports until there is a successful, if you will, resolve to this enormous and cohesive strike that Georgia State prisoners have engaged in.
You all for getting the word out.
And we have been speaking with President Edward Dubose of the Georgia State Conference of the NAACP.
Now, to place the important issue of prison labor in a national perspective, we now go to an excerpt from an excellent documentary, Prison Labor, Made in the USA, produced by Free Speech Radio News.
Prison labor is every U.S. corporation's dream. Cheap labor, no sick leave, no time off, no holidays, and employees can be easily replaced. For human rights activists, however, it's a nightmare for the very same reasons, but on the other side of the coin, forced labor, no unions, low pay, and no protection for employees. The U.S. has used or currently uses prison labor for everything from holiday coffee for Starbucks, cutting airplane components for Boeing, Game Boys for Nintendo, equipment for the war in Iraq, shrink-wrapping mouses for Microsoft, making dentures, down to sewing lingerie for Victoria's Secret. It's a multi-billion dollar business, and today, FSRN brings you an exclusive documentary, Prison Labor, Made in the USA. I'm Aura Bogado. Reporter Karen Miller takes a look at prison labor in the U.S.
Tom Petersick is a prison rights activist and an economist. He says having the government be the federal prison's only buyer breeds trouble.
The key problem with federal prison industries and prison industries in general today is that we have granted those industries a monopoly. And that monopoly has exclusive access to the labor force, the incarcerated labor force, and it has exclusive access to government markets for the sale of inmate-produced products. In addition to that, it is exempt from labor law, it is exempt from taxation, and it is subsidized by the U.S. taxpayer.
The Justice System Improvement Act also gave states a boost. Heather Thompson.
So, for example, in New Jersey, their Department of Corrections got a new marketing slogan, which was, "And you thought we only made license plates," because, in fact, they started to make a whole lot of other things. And they began. They were making everything from desks to school furniture to, you just can't imagine. In fact, you can go on any state website and see the amount of products.
Etta is in the women's prison in Jessup, Maryland. She's the clerk of a sew shop where she started off as a seamstress. Etta has been in jail for over 30 years.
I like getting up early in the morning, and I like the different variety of people that I have to work with. There are all kinds of people here with all kinds of talents and all kinds of problems. So not only am I a clerk, I also help them socially get back into whatever it is that they need to get back into. I'm more of a big sister to a lot of the people here.
She talks about the inventory.
Trousers and pants, the jackets, State Highway attire, those neon vests that you see on the highway, we make those. We make dietary uniforms. We make hospital gowns for different state facilities, things of that nature.
As the products began to grow, so did the problems. Prison rights activist Tom Petersick says since prisons usually don't have competition with buyers and outside workforces, it can set the stage for the exploitation of the prisoners.
Any economics textbook that talks about monopoly will accent the relative power of the bargaining components, the buyer and the seller, and so forth. So if they're both relatively powerful, then you'll see that the person over whom the monopoly is exercised will have some power against the monopolist, and things might look more or less like competition. But where there are huge power differences, and where there's particularly social opprobrium and isolation, you will see huge abuses of the group over which the monopoly is exercised. And prisoners fall exactly into that category. They're hidden from view. They're disliked by the community in general. And the monopoly is free to behave. There's no one else for the inmate to turn to.
Nowhere to turn also means no unions. In the 1977 case, Jones versus North Carolina Prisoners Labor Union, the U.S. Supreme Court removed court protection from prison labor organizing. Thompson explains.
They had held neither the First Amendment rights that other workers would have, nor the Equal Protection Clause that unions enjoyed. And so as a result, there are no unions in prison. And this is tremendously significant because it means that workers, for example, if there's toxic fumes in the place they're working, they have no basis upon which to challenge that. If they're getting terrible wages, they have no basis upon which to challenge that.
They also don't have the basis for other things. Take, for instance, sick time. At her data entry job, Gina knows no work means no money.
Well, if somebody's sick, usually we relay messages, you know, amongst ourselves to the supervisor. If we have someone that lives in our housing unit and it doesn't feel well, she'll, you know, say, can you please let Lancy know that I don't feel well today, so I'm not coming in. She won't get her base rate. She won't get her keystrokes.
And for some prisoners, not going to work is not an option either. In some states, it's mandatory that prisoners work, and forced labor is just that, forced. If you don't work, there are consequences. Vince was serving a life sentence for robbery. After 10 years, he got his sentence overturned. While in a penitentiary, he worked at a sawmill. Life for those who refused to work was a hard one.
Well, the hole is just how it sounds. It's a place you don't want to be in. It's a place where your privileges are taken away from you. You have a loss of privileges. Your TV, your radio, your little hot plate. And in my case, you know, they wouldn't put anybody in my cell. And, you know, I thought that made it even worse for me because a lot of times people have somebody to talk to or play dominoes or cards in the cell or whatever. But the hole basically is a place where, you know, people are angry and frustrated about their conditions and they flood the toilets and they set fires and throw toilet paper out on the tier. They scream and shake the boss so much that you feel like you're about to have a nervous breakdown because nobody will be quiet. People will do anything for attention or whatever when their mind is idle. And it's just like somebody saying, shut up all that noise. I found that in the end, that silence can drive you just as crazy. You know, and people need each other. And so a person would rather have a bad relationship with you with some sort of foul communication as opposed to no communication or human contact whatsoever.
If being in the hole is not enough, the pay or lack of it may just do it. Gina says she has one of the best jobs in her prison doing data entry.
A good batch right here is like, this is about an average batch. And I probably got like about $2.92 for that batch.
And it took you about an hour to do that batch? About 2 hours.
2 hours,
okay,
yeah.
Okay. So that would be about, is it $8 a day?
Usually it's about $8, you know, a good day would probably be like $10 a day.
Even some in jail know they're not getting paid what they're worth. Etta from the Sew Shop.
They can't get better quality for a cheaper price than they do right here. Because what we make here is no comparison to what you would have to pay for on the outside. We make $3 a day where in the free world, you may have to pay somebody $12 an hour to sew a particular garment. So I think that, you know, we fare much better, and the quality of work that we put out is absolutely great.
There's always been low pay, and there's always been holes. But the biggest shift prison labor has seen over the last couple of decades is who is hiring the prisoners, private companies who are looking for cheap labor. Again, Heather Thompson.
What they call a cost competitive and motivated workforce, and they get a great deal. So we have all kinds of companies that now use or have used prison labor, and we could name some of them. Some of them: Kmart, Honda, McDonald's, Hawaiian Tropic Products, Burger King, Victoria's Secret, Allstate Insurance, Nike, you know, there's just all kinds of them. And sometimes they're using services, like, for example, a phone bank system. They're using prisoners to make the phones and sometimes they're actually using the physical labor of prisoners.
Some of this work is done in private prisons. In a private prison, the prisoner is sentenced by the state, but is jailed by a private company. Thompson says labor done in these types of prisons can be even more troubling.
Who's going to be in charge of the medical needs of the prisoner? Who's going to be in charge of safety conditions? Who's going to be in charge of work hours? Who's going to be in charge of any of this? And the answer is, there's very little regulation. So private prisons have an even it's even more problematic, because then we don't even have any state regulation whatsoever to really count on.
Safety and regulation, or the lack of it, has always been an issue for those working in jail. Vince was in a federal prison for over 10 years.
This guy, his name was Vanderbilt, they started calling him Vanderhoof because his hand was cut off by one of those big machines, and they scooped his hand up and put it in some ice and took it back, and they actually sewed his hand back on. And a couple of his fingers he could move, but they saved some of his hand and put his hand back on. So people started calling him Vanderhoof. So I remember that the guy's whole right hand was just whopped off by one of those big saws from him not paying attention. Those saws are so big, just the sound of the saws on can unsettle your spirit after you've been around them for a little while. Even if you've been there working in the factory for a couple of years, it's like something you don't get used to hearing.
For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Karen Miller.
You've been listening to an exclusive FSRN documentary titled Prison Labor, Made in the USA, with reporter Karen Miller. Produced by Vinod K. Joes. Technical production by Antonio Ortiz. This documentary is made possible by Pacifica Radio, community radio affiliate stations, and listener supporters. I'm Aura Bogado.
Well, this has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg.
And Ken Nash. And log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.